It's Thursday, April 30, 2015. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. President Obama pointed to the streets of Baltimore, declaring that the nation now faces what he called a slow-rolling crisis. The streets of Baltimore, Maryland, are a bit calmer and quieter than they were earlier this week. Violence erupted on the street, including serious injuries to several Baltimore police officers, and as late as yesterday evening, firefighters in the city were saying that they were reluctant to answer fire calls because of the threat of violence against themselves on the central core streets of Baltimore. One of the things that looms in the background of this is yet another unexplained arrest and a death after that arrest. In this case, the 25-year-old young man who was arrested, an African-American young man, was Freddie Gray. And somewhere after his arrest, he suffered an injury to his spinal column that led to his death. That led to controversy, immediate protests, and even violence on the streets of Baltimore, a violent pattern that is highly revealing of where we now stand as a nation. There were riveting scenes that came from the streets of Baltimore. Earlier this week, one of those scenes was the burning of a CVS drugstore after it had been looted by protesters on the street. It was then set fire. And as the Wall Street Journal reported, hundreds of people gathered at a West Baltimore corner on Tuesday where a CVS pharmacy stood empty and charred from Monday's riots. In a building next door, a dozen senior citizens watched the news and wondered where they would now buy their groceries and prescriptions. One of the aspects that is most depressing about this is that the people who were doing the protesting and the looting, in this case also the arson, were basically doing damage to their own community. They were burning down a CVS store that was a vital asset in their own community. That leads to some of the most revealing insights that come out of the situation there in Baltimore. President Obama, in his statements directed towards the situation in Baltimore, said what you would expect a president of the United States to say. He condemned the protesting in the streets and especially the violence and the looting, but he also referred to, again, what he called the nation's slow-rolling crisis, going all the way back to the incident in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. Now the president said the nation's going to have to confront the serious issues that underlie the violence on the streets of Baltimore, but the most immediate concern is ending the violence that is taking place in that Maryland city. The president said that his thoughts were with the police officers who had been injured in the violence on Monday night. He also pointed to what he called, quote, too many instances of what appears to be police officers interacting with individuals, primarily African Americans, often poor, in ways that raise troubling questions. That's when the president said, this has been a slow rolling crisis. This has been going on for a long time. This is not new, and we shouldn't pretend that it's new, end quote. I have defended President Obama's responses in so many of these very tragic incidents because he is speaking as virtually any president of the United States would be required to speak. But even as the president has said these words, and even as he said the nation needs to address these issues, not even the president has offered a plan for how exactly these issues are to be addressed. And that points to one of the most basic insights the Christian worldview should bring to this situation. We'd often discuss the fact that politics and economics require a certain level of trust. Society itself, civilization, is an achievement. It requires a certain level of trust. What you see in terms of the pathologies that are being played out before the nation's eyes in Baltimore is a breakdown of that basic structure and order that depends on trust. And the trust is broken down not only in the streets of Baltimore, but elsewhere. But the New York Times yesterday ran a very instructive graphic showing patterns of economic poverty and of shortened life expectancy, block by block and neighborhood by neighborhood in Baltimore. And one of the things the New York Times shows is that there is a very clear concentration of those two pathologies, of low life expectancy and of increased unemployment and poverty in the very areas where the violence has been breaking out in that city and the very neighborhood where Freddie Gray was arrested. The violence has come with a very high toll. Just in terms of the report that came in yesterday's Wall Street Journal, city officials said that fires had consumed 19 buildings and 144 vehicles, while at least 20 police officers had been injured and 235 people had been arrested. As the Wall Street Journal said, on Tuesday, shop owners covered storefronts with plywood and many residents swept debris from streets. The acrid smell of charred vehicles and buildings hung in the air, end quote. That's the kind of picture that we would hope would never characterize any city or any neighborhood in America, but it has, and it has repeatedly so in recent months. The editorial board of the New York Times on Wednesday suggested that the problem was at least twofold. They also went to President Obama's comments. The editors wrote, President Obama has condemned as inexcusable the looting and arson that spread across the face of the city after Mr. Gray's funeral. But he also implied that the Baltimore Police Department had, quote, to do some soul searching. The editors then said, indeed it does. A well-documented history of extreme brutality and misconduct set the stage for just this kind of unrest, end quote. The editors also pointed to the president when they said that the response would require new police tactics and new policies aimed at helping communities where jobs have disappeared, improving education, and helping ex-offenders find jobs, end quote. That was the editorial board of the New York Times. The editors of that paper have been pressing an urban agenda identified with the term progressivism for the better part of the last half century. And the editors now say that in response, the same kind of combination of government action and of reforms of the law will need to take place. As if in response, the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal pointed to the violence on the streets of Baltimore and called it a severe indictment on that very progressivist vision of America's urban cities. The editors of the Journal pointed to the progressivists and said this model, with its reliance on government and public unions, has dominated urban America as once vibrant cities such as Baltimore became shells of their former selves. The editors point out that in 1960, Baltimore was America's sixth largest city with 940,000 people. The editors then say it has since shed nearly a third of its population and today isn't even in the top 25. The editors go on to describe the dysfunctions of the blue city model, as they call it. They say the dysfunctions are many, but the main features are three: high crime, low economic growth, and failing public schools that serve primarily as jobs programs for teachers and administrators rather than places of learning, end quote. The same charts that the New York Times showed when it comes to low life expectancy and high poverty can be correlated also with something else that's very important from the Christian worldview, and that is the breakdown of the family. Now, this leads to another very interesting exchange when it comes to the question of the relationship between the absence of fathers and the violence that took place on the streets of Baltimore. Philip Bump, writing for the Washington Post, pointed to comments that had been made by Senator Rand Paul, a declared candidate for the Republican presidential nomination, when he pointed to what he called the breakdown of the family structure there in Baltimore, the lack of fathers, the lack of a sort of moral code in our society. Paul went on to say this isn't just a racial thing, it goes across racial boundaries, end quote. That is profoundly true. This isn't just a racial thing. Even as the high rate of babies born out of wedlock and fatherlessness began, especially in terms of pathologies, in the African-American family in the 1960s, the reality is that the skyrocketing rates of babies born out of wedlock and children being raised without fathers is no longer a racial issue. It has spread across all ethnic and racial groups in America. Senator Paul's reference to a lack of fathers was criticized by many on the left, while others pointed to the fact that another major American politician, in response to the same kind of urban unrest in the aftermath of Ferguson, Missouri, had made a similar statement. That American politician said, quote, in communities where there are no fathers who can provide guidance to young men, communities where there's no investment and manufacturing has been stripped away and drugs have flooded the community and the drug industry ends up being the primary employer for a whole lot of folks in those environments, if we think that we're just going to send the police to do the dirty work of containing the problems that arise there without, as a nation and as a society, saying what we can do to change those communities, to help lift those communities and give those kids opportunity, then we're not going to solve the problem, end quote. Again, that American politician pointed in the first place to communities in which there are no fathers, especially who can provide guidance to young men. That politician was the president of the United States. Christians looking at this situation and praying for peace, not only on the streets of Baltimore, but elsewhere as well, must pray for the restoration of social trust, and they must pray for the restoration of a moral order. That is a basic requirement of civilization. And we're watching the breakdown of trust, and the picture of the CVS burning was just one of those pictures. Perhaps one of the most significant parables in picture before us was the fact that the Baltimore Orioles and the Chicago White Sox played to what had never happened before, an empty baseball stadium, simply out of fear of the fact that the violence would spread to the baseball game as well. Christians operating out of a biblical worldview have to be very, very careful lest we just give superficial answers to what are very deep problems. But the fact is that Christians alone, operating out of a biblical worldview, understand just how deep, how intractable those problems really are, and how impossible it is, even following on the logic of the President of the United States, to rebuild a society, to rebuild a moral order on the streets of a city like Baltimore without rebuilding the community itself. And what's central to the biblical worldview is the understanding that it is impossible to rebuild the community without rebuilding the family. The President of the United States made reference to that, but Christians have to do more than make reference to that fact. We have to point to the reality that the recovery of the family is prior and primary to the recovery of community at any other level, and the breakdown of the family will inevitably lead to the breakdown of the civilization. Finally, in the aftermath of the national controversy over Ferguson, Missouri, one of the things that was pointed out is the difficulty of rebuilding that trust when you have elected officials who are overwhelmingly white and a community that is increasingly African-American. We can certainly understand the fact that the logic of democracy is weakened when the government doesn't look like the people the government is called upon to serve. But one of the things to note in Baltimore is that fixing that picture doesn't necessarily fix the larger problem. Because in Baltimore, the city has an African-American mayor and an African-American police commissioner, and neither one is the first African-American in that position. The legitimacy of democracy does require that an elected leadership look like the community that it represents, but it also points to the fact that even that's not enough. Without trust, without the family, without rebuilding society, without, as the president said, rebuilding the community, and the family has to come first, there will be no long-term recovery, no long-term answers to what happened in Baltimore. The Supreme Court's oral arguments in the same-sex marriage case tended to crowd out other worthy headlines. One of them occurred over the weekend. It came in the business pages of the Wall Street Journal, the Saturday-Sunday edition of the weekend. The headline was this: Abercrombie is dialing back the sex. It's a really interesting article. The company, known as Abercrombie & Fitch, the revival of a rather legacy American brand in a highly sexualized form in the 1990s and beyond. Well, this article says that Abercrombie, due to its own need to survive as a corporation, is dialing back the overt sexuality. But as you might expect, there's a lot more to this story than the headline might even imply. This is a story that is laden with worldview importance, even as it was buried within the business pages of America's most influential business newspaper. The article's by reporters Suzanne Kapner and Joanne Lublin. As they report, teen retailer Abercrombie & Fitch Company is putting an end to the beefcake. The question is, what's next? They go on to report, in a series of personnel policies announced last Friday, the company said it would stop hiring sales staff on body type or physical attractiveness, and will relax its infamous look policy, that's put in quotation marks, so that employees can dress in a more individualistic way. Brand representative will replace model as the title for sales staff. They go on to report that store openings and other corporate events will no longer be, as they said, decorated with shirtless male models, and the company's sex-tinged marketing is being dialed back as well. Abercrombie said in a news release, quote, by the end of July, interesting they're putting this off until the end of July, by the end of July, there will no longer be sexualized marketing used in marketing materials, including in-store photos, gift cards, and shopping bags. Oh, and there's one exception the company allows, it says, for this ceasefire it declares in terms of sexuality. It says that its fragrances will continue to advertise in a very sexualized way because, they say, the fragrance industry itself is so highly sexualized. Write that down as a note. The print edition of the Wall Street Journal over the weekend has a paragraph that reads like this. The changes, many of which were championed by the new heads of Abercrombie and Hollister brands, those are united in terms of Abercrombie and Fitch Company, amount to a broad repudiation of the highly sexual tone set by former chief executive Mike Jeffries. He created a cult following with teens who clamored for Abercrombie's logo-emblazoned T-shirts and sweatshirts and willingly paid full price for tattered jeans. But, they say, the formula started to falter in recent years as teen shoppers gravitated to cheaper, fast fashion competitors. What's interesting is to compare the print edition of this article with the online edition that preceded it in terms of the Wall Street Journal's website. That online edition had included a statement about former chief executive Mike Jeffress that read like this, quote, he also courted controversy. Comments in a 2006 interview with online publication Salon, in which he said the company's target market was, quote, good-looking people, end quote, sparked a backlash and fueled animosity among many teens. The approach turned into a liability, said the journal then, worsening pressure on the company's sales coming out of the recession, end quote. It should be very interesting that that paragraph that appeared Friday on the online edition disappeared Saturday and Sunday in the print edition. The Abercrombie story comes as a parable to those who operate out of a biblical worldview. One of the realities that we come to see here is that the highly sexualized marketing approach undertaken by Abercrombie simply can't fulfill on its promises. You can adopt a highly sexualized approach like this, but eventually it's almost like is the case with pornography, very revealing in terms of the pattern of sin. There's no way to keep dialing up the sexuality and remain in a mall. And at some point, even the teenagers and the young adults to whom Abercrombie had been marketing these highly sexualized images, at some point, they are no longer interested in seeing the same old thing, even from Abercrombie. But in that online edition of the Wall Street Journal, going back to quote the former CEO, there is more here than may meet the eye. There's actually more here than meets the eye in the print edition of the same newspaper. That's where the former CEO had acknowledged in 2006 that not only was the company hiring on the basis of what they described as physical attractiveness and sexuality, they were also selling to a marketing group that they described as, quote, good-looking people, end quote. This gets back to the Christian worldview affirmation that truth and goodness and beauty are always united. The Christian worldview tells us that we can never separate those things without creating a sinful fissure that will eventually crack apart, and the crack-up now has reached Abercrombie and Fitch. Choosing this highly sexualized marketing technique, putting out what amounted to softcore pornography in advertising for many years, trying to entice teenagers and young adults to come into its stores with a highly sexualized aesthetic, all this began to break apart when it became immediately clear that putting on Abercrombie's clothes did not make one physically attractive, and it became an absolutely repulsive marketing technique when the CEO of the company admitted that they were actually trying to sell to good-looking people, by the definition of this company, and they were trying to use good-looking people in terms of physical and sexual attractiveness in terms of their advertising. It should tell us a great deal that for Abercrombie and Fitch, that eventually became a losing strategy. But you could read that right out of the book of Genesis. Those who live by a code of physical attractiveness will die by a code of physical attractiveness. Those who try to build a marketing empire and a public relations momentum when it comes to highly sexualized images will eventually die by those highly sexualized images. Trying to separate the good, the beautiful, and the true, as pornography always does, including marketing that amounts to softcore pornography, eventually it is a project that falls apart on its face. Oh, and by the way, having taken an approach that eventually failed, observers of Abercrombie & Fitch have grave doubts the company can recover. It's because losing that story doesn't mean they gain any other story. And having built an empire on this highly sexualized idea of personal attractiveness, having been repudiated by teenagers and young adults who decided to take their business elsewhere, there's no good reason for anyone to come back. And that's why even in the view of the Wall Street Journal, not looking this from a moral angle, but merely from a financial angle, this new approach by Abercrombie and Fitch is by no means destined to succeed. Finally, a lesson to learn by looking at the media telling the story. Trillia Newbell of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention ran an article yesterday in the Washington Post pointing out that even in Baltimore, maybe we should say especially in Baltimore, there is good news to be seen. And she called for the media to give attention to that good news. What's the good news? Well, the cameras are looking at the burning buildings. They are drawn to that kind of image. They are drawn to the burning cars and the protesters on the street. We can understand why. But the cameras are largely absent, showing the people from these same neighborhoods who go out to sweep the glass up and try to rebuild the community. The cameras are rarely there when you see a parent parenting, doing what it takes to keep a child off the streets. The cameras are rarely there when you see a pastor and when you see others in the community ministering together to show what it means to call people to righteousness, even as they call a community to justice. It's very important that those of us who are outside a city like Baltimore understand that what we are seeing in terms of the media are the images the media finds interesting. It's actually even more profound than that. What we are watching are the images that the national media believe we will find interesting. That tells us a great deal not only about the media, but about ourselves. And Trillia Newbell is exactly right. The cameras simply aren't there far too often to tell the story of the people who are healing their communities rather than destroying them. The people who are standing in the breach rather than destroying the bridges. The people who are building and sustaining their families, even under very difficult circumstances. We need to make very certain that as we pray for the people of Baltimore, we pray not only for the end of violence, we pray not only for righteousness and justice to prevail, we pray for the sustenance of that community and for the encouragement of everything good that can and is taking place there. One woman from that neighborhood, a mom, became an instant national celebrity when she was seen physically pulling her 16-year-old boy off the streets, pulling her son out of danger, and chastising him for ever having been involved in what was taking place on the streets. That mother explained what she was doing, even as she became something of an instant national heroine, when she said that she didn't want her 16-year-old son to become another Freddie Gray. We certainly understand her concern. We understand the urgency behind her intervention. But what we also need to remember is that there are thousands of similar mothers, and there are many, many fathers who are doing the very same thing in their own way, not caught by camera, simply doing what mothers and fathers do, keeping their children off the streets, doing what churches do, offering hope in the gospel, doing what Christians do, seeking to be salt and light. Most of that is far off camera. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.